This hour, we'll take your phone calls with Professor Heino Falca as we talk about his book, Light in the Darkness, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back, George Norrie with you, Professor Heino Falca with us, his book, Light in the Darkness. Is there a Nobel Prize for Science here for you, Heino, coming up?
Oh, that's not about me to speculate. Let others do that.
Okay. And your team, of course.
Yes, it's a team effort for sure.
Well, you deserve it. So let's keep our fingers crossed. That would be fantastic. And do they award those every year, or does it vary?
You mean the Nobel Prize? Yeah, there's one every year. And last year, it actually went to black holes. To my colleague, Reinhard Genzel. Yes. So they discovered they used stars to measure the dark mass in the center of the Milky Way. And we are going one step closer even. You know, they pointed out to say, oh, there is something that is really 4 million times the mass of the sun concentrated in a small region. And we are now, working on data to look at it and find out how it looks like. There's still more data to come at some point.
What is fueling our knowledge of things like in the universe? Is it technology? What's doing it?
It's curiosity, right? I think that was with us from the first view towards the stars. The first time humans looked at the sky, I think they were wondering about what's out there, what's going on there, and then they had an intuitive feeling about, there's something deeper and bigger out there. You look at all the prophets of the Bible. They say, look up. Who created all of this? We're talking about the sun, the moon, and the stars. There's something big and countless stars in the universe. So they had a sense of something big out there, and I think this has always been a longing with us to find out what else is there.
So much. It's just exciting. If you had a chance to talk with Albert Einstein, what would you talk with him about?
That's a very good question. I would ask him about his view how to get his theory and quantum physics together. He may not, because that's one of the big unsolved questions. Mm-hmm. Is your theory, Albert, the last word, or is there more? Can we go beyond it? And that's a big question these days.
Let's go to the calls. Carl in Boston, Mass. To get us started. Hi, Carl.
Hi, George. I'm so excited to get on tonight. Hi, Professor.
Hi.
I had a couple comments and a couple questions. I'll make my comments short, my questions short.
Okay.
Classic physics and quantum physics don't exactly jive together. Like you said, Albert Einstein would have to question what is a quanta. But my question is, since we have anti-gravity technology, would it not be possible to get close to a black hole and just hover over it or collect data around it? And my next question is, would it be possible to send a light particle, connect a radio frequency to it, and shoot it through a black hole with anti-gravity around it, antimatter, I mean? And do you think that's possible? And I think it's all my
Yeah, okay, good question. It's not anti. You don't need anti-gravity. We don't even know what anti-gravity is. You need a lot of energy, right? So you could, in principle, hover above a black hole. If you just provide you have enough energy, you could hover above a black hole, and you'd see an amazing universe. You'd see, as I said, in the last hour, you'd see the rest of the universe speed up, for example. Of course, if you come back, all your loved ones will be dead. I mean, your grandchildren's grandchildren's would be around.
Oh my! If there's a planet to come back to, right?
Yeah, there's no planet to come back to. It may already be destroyed. You don't know what what the future will look like. But for that, you need a huge amount of energy, and I think the only energy we know of that is sort of the most the most amount of energy you can have is. It's really antimatter, which does exist, which we can produce. You'd have to produce sort of some kind of an antimatter battery and store all kinds of energy. Maybe that will be enough to keep you, get you close to a black hole and above and out. But that technology is, you know, far from, you know, anywhere being realized. You know, we can produce a few hundreds of thousands of antimatter particles and maybe, you know, deal with them, but that's it. You need milligrams and more.
There's still so much we don't know, isn't there?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. Yes and no. We have a sense where things are going, right? We know about antimatter. Mm-hmm. We know about what theory of relativity predicts and what's roughly possible. So, I mean, in the last 100 years, we have not been sort of mightily surprised. You know, many of the things that we found with an experiment were things that had been premeditated by a theory and a little bit extrapolated. And so, but, you know, thinking about it, many different possibilities, and realizing it is, of course, a big difference, right? So, I mean, many dreams and which one becomes true. That's what the experiment needs to tell us. So for now, I think we have to look at telescopes at black holes, and going there. I mean, apart from the fact these are, you know, 50 million light years away, right? So the ones I was, you know, you made the first image of, it would take 50 million years to get there.
A long time.
It's a long time. You have a lot of patience. You know, at some point, don't forget the universe is huge. It's huge, and there may be things that are beyond what, you know, we little people, humans, can do.
Is it endless?
That's a very good question. We don't know. Well, we know for sure that the universe, the observable universe, has an end, so to speak, because it has a finite age. Everything that has a finite age cannot be infinite. Yeah, and I even believe infinity doesn't exist in the real universe. You cannot. You know, you can never touch infinity. It's always out of your reach. And what's beyond what we cannot see, we don't know, right? So we just cannot know.
Right.
And there is a limit to what we can know. And maybe at some point some, you know, being humble as people is also part of your life. You will not be able to ever know everything.
The scientists, Dr. That came up with the multiverse theories. Mm-hmm. What was it that compelled them to come up with a theory that there might be other universes?
Well, I think it's part theological, so to speak. I remember those discussions. And the idea was, you know, how can it be that this universe is so unique, right? That it's almost impossible to have everything fit together so well without a creator. So let's assume then we have a big gambling machine, and you're gambling and you're creating universes just for fun all the time, and then eventually one of them will work, okay? So that was the idea. But statistically, that still doesn't solve the questions, because, you know, you don't know where all the other where did the multi-universes come from. Yeah, so it you know, theologically, it doesn't solve the theological question. It could still be right. But and the idea is that you have those quantum fluctuations, that the space is full of quantum fluctuations. Occasionally, one of those grows and becomes, you know, via inflation, pops out of sort of this quantum vacuum that there is. But again, you know, it doesn't solve the fundamental question, and it you know, needs to be measured at some point. Right. If it's science, it has to be measured. And so we're still looking for ways whether there is any possibility at all to see whether there are other universes. Maybe there aren't.
Let's go to Port Angeles, Washington, and Tom is with us, west of the Rockies. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hello, George. Hello, Professor.
Hey.
On the creation aspect of it, I think if this was all nothing for a long, long time, we've all heard the expression, nature abhors a vacuum. So eventually something was going to have to happen. On the solar system side and on the galactic side, I wonder what your thoughts would be on how to navigate the stars. We got a lot of things out there that are pretty noisy and they're relatively stationary. But how do we detect black holes when we're trying to get our IPCs out to the interplanetary cargo craft, right, out to the other planets? How do we monitor black holes that might be moving through the galaxy and stuff? What kind of instruments do we need?
Yeah, well, we use the entire, you know, all the instruments we have. We have optical telescopes, X-ray, radio, and black holes, for example, emit at all wavelengths. That's one of the beauty of black holes. You know, this picture we made with radio telescopes, but they also emit X-ray emission and optical emission. And so depending what their properties are, sometimes X-ray is stronger, sometimes others. So I think we can, you know, and sometimes they're dark. Now, there could be black holes which are almost completely dark, hardly detectable because no matter falls in there. They don't produce any energy. You know, we are able to see them if they're radiating. We can localize them. We can localize them very precisely. And in fact, you mentioned navigation. One little detail I want to mention is that if you do navigation today on the ground, in the end, everything is tied. Our navigational landmarks are supermassive black holes out there in the universe. It's massive quasars that we, you know, look at with radio telescope. We know exactly where they are, and they are so far away that they don't move. They are sort of our landmarks relatively to which we can determine our location of the Earth and the orientation and the orientation of the polar axis, for example, relative to that celestial reference frame. So we do use actually black holes already now implicitly for navigation. Isn't that amazing?
It is. On the international line, Shane is with us in Rye, Australia. Hey, Shane. Hi.
Yeah, g'day, George. Great fan of yours, mate. Love your program, mate.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And g'day, Doctor. You're a great service for humanity doing the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Look, I look at generational behavior within the social system of Australia, but I just wanted to ask you, we've had such an acceleration of population technologies, wondrous technologies that are available, but we've got this huge population problem, and it looks like, specifically in Australia, but we've got massive problems with environmental degradation and what I'd say a mass extinction event. And I find it fascinating that we've got so much intelligence as a species, but on the other hand, we seem to be blinded by the primal instincts that seem to be dominating us still subconsciously, Doctor. And as a scientist, I'd like you to give us the impression of what the scientific fields or the scientific minds think of that understanding.
Yeah, that's a very good point you're making. You know, there's this joke among people looking for, you know, extraterrestrial intelligence. They say we have to look for extraterrestrial intelligence in the universe because we haven't found it on Earth. Because
yeah.
We sometimes behave very stupidly on Earth. It's pretty clear that, you know, resources are limited, and every system with certain technology comes to a limit, and we see that happening right now. So with pollution and climate and other things, and I think people are worried. And the thing about scientists is they look a little bit further. They look, you know, a little bit towards the future, and they can tell people to say and warn them and say, look, you know, be mindful of the fact that resources are limited, right? So if you were a farmer, right? I mean, you can grow and you can get more out of your fields, but there is a limit to it. At some point, you're abusing your land.
Right.
At some point, you're abusing your animals. You can also work very hard yourself. You can be more efficient, but at some point, you're abusing yourself. And I think the same is happening with our Earth. It will be limited. We'll need new technologies. We'll need cleaner technologies for energy. We need to make sure that, you know, we reuse the resources that we can't just spoil all the time, you know. I must say, I'm a German. I lived in the U.S. for a little while. And, you know, I grew up and I was told, you know, I have to eat what's on the table and I have to be mindful of the food. And that's just, you know, because I guess we came from poor backgrounds, you know, 100 years ago. And I got to the U.S. And you know, everybody, you, there was a big plastic things put on the table, and food was put on there, and then you know, the kids, this was in kindergarten, the kids were just eating a little bit, and then everything was wrapped up and thrown away. Was just all the food was thrown away, all the plastic was thrown away, and I was just like, no, just be mindful, you know, throw the food away, and waste all this stuff. So it's, I think, you know, technology is fantastic, but let's be mindful that our resources are always limited, and let's use them in a wise way. Let's be good caretakers of this world. That is important.
Absolutely. Next up, let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Heino, thank you so much for your work and efforts on finding this black hole. I remember when I first saw the picture of it on the front page of the New York Times, and it absolutely captivated my imagination. So just thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
So I had a quick comment and question tonight. So the black hole, which you found, was in the center of the M87 galaxy, which is, you know, it's about 55 million light years from Earth. And when you're going through the process of finding this black hole and, you know, the process of finding the galaxy and searching it, was there any way of kind of narrowing it down to finding the black hole in that specific M87 galaxy? And how much ground did you travel finding this black hole? Because I know that, you know, like I said, the black hole was found about 50 million miles from Earth. How far out did you and your team kind of venture out in space miles in the search for this black hole?
Yeah, now 50 million light years indeed. And that's an interesting story. But, you know, we didn't start from scratch. This is the result of 100 years of research in the end. You know, that galaxy was found by Heber Curtis, actually in the U.S., in 1918, and he saw that galaxy, and he saw a little streak of light there, and he was wondering what it was. At the time, they didn't know this was a galaxy. They didn't know how far it was away. They had no clue this was a black hole. And at the same time, Einstein had, you know, formulated relativity, and the, you know, the mathematics of black holes came about, but nobody had any clue that these two things would have anything to do with each other. Well, the course of almost 100 years became clear that in the center, this is a galaxy, and in this center there is something really big and massive. And we just didn't know how massive it was. But, you know, by the time we're doing our experiment, we knew this is the one of the closest supermassive black holes. Of the really big, big guys in the universe, this is the closest that we have, because we have mapped out the entire universe. And so we were looking at the two biggest candidates, the one in our, the center of our Milky Way, that's a big galaxy, a supermassive black hole, and the one in this one. And we were just lucky. That was just big enough that we could see it. You know, had it been a bit smaller, factor two smaller, which the error bars would have allowed, we wouldn't have seen anything. So, you know, don't, you know, think that we're sitting down and say, okay, what could we look at today? You know, this is a consequence of many decades of research. It was pretty much clear there are two supermassive black holes which are big and nearby. Let's try to look at them. It's a lot of astrophysics that, you know, you have to do first to get there.
Absolutely. Professor, we're going to take a quick break and come back with final phone calls for you. Our special guest, Professor Heino Falke, his book, Light in the Darkness. It's available now, just coming out in the United States, and check it out on Amazon.com. It's a great read for you. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you with Professor Heino Falke. We're talking about his work, Light in the Darkness, as he sought to get a picture of a black hole for 25 years. Why did you never give up? I'm fascinated by that, I know.
I knew it would come at some point. I knew it was possible, and of course, you never know whether, you know, you're going to be part of it.
Right. You're going to live long enough, right?
Long live enough, but I knew it was possible. We had the technology in hand. I knew what to do. You have to, you know, convince other people. You had to rely on others to work together to make it happen, and you know, with 350 scientists from very different cultures, you know, with Asia, with US, with Europe, different backgrounds. Things can go any direction. But in the end, I think it became a common vision, a common dream. Everybody wanted to see this. And there was a lot of hardship, a lot of trouble among us. But, everybody wanted to see it. You want to go to the limits of space and time to see something that nobody has ever seen before. We see a world that's so crazy that, it looks like science fiction. It became science reality. And, I think that fascination and that curiosity, that's what drives us.
Was there a moment you almost gave up?
Yeah, there were some moments where you had the feeling like, that's not going to work. I'm a pessimist anyway, right? When we went to the mountain in 2017, did our observations, and I thought, well, the weather will be bad, the technology will break down, the apparatus, because they do on the Hind Mountains once in a while, and the black hole will look very different. Right? It turned out the weather was perfect. All the machines worked, and the black hole was as big as it could have been, and it was a beautiful image. That was a big surprise and a pleasant surprise.
Do you ever think we're going to develop anti-gravity for propulsion systems?
No. I think eventually we'll have antimatter. That'll give us a huge amount of energy, but we'll not be able to travel faster than the speed of light. So I don't believe in warp drives in the end, even though I love them in science fiction movies.
Yep. Yep.
I don't see that even with, the biggest creativity and stretch of my imagination will actually get there, because you need things that may not exist in our universe. And so it doesn't mean we cannot explore, but it will require a lot of more patience than we, are used to these days. We want everything quick and now, but, maybe you have to travel slowly with almost only the speed of light.
Is a wormhole like a black hole, or is that something different?
Well, it's actually, it's the opposite of a black hole. It's sort of a connection of a black hole and a white hole, so you go in and you go out at the other side. And that's a mathematically valid solution of Einstein's theory. Question only is, do they exist in nature, and could you make one that is actually traversable, that you can go through it? And that seems to require matter that doesn't exist, negative energy matter.
Because I think if there are extraterrestrials, that's how they're traveling.
Yeah, and maybe God prevented that from happening. Maybe good so.
Maybe good.
Yeah.
Let's take some calls for you. Let's go to Eva in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the program. Hi, Eva.
Hi. Hi, George and Dr. Folka.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. And I also wanted to say thank you, George, for having Dr. Folka on.
Oh, you're really very welcome. Our staff found him, and he's a great guy.
Yeah, thank you. For Dr. Folka, I was looking at the black hole situation, we're observing black holes at the centers of galaxies. And so one of my working theories lately is that black holes are functioning like the hub of a bicycle, holding the galactic matter in juxtaposition, like a countervailing force to keep is that pretty understood in the field, or is that...
Well, it's, it's one thing you have to realize, as massive as black holes are, they are still tiny compared to the mass of the entire galaxy, right? So even if you're just going, a light year away from the center of the Milky Way, a light year isn't much, right? The next star is
right, not in space time.
So light year, actually, in terms of cosmic distances, is small. But in the center of a galaxy, we have, millions of stars within a light year already. So the star has become much more massive than the black hole at a certain distance. So the black hole on its own is not able to anchor everything. But it is in the very center. That's where everything rotates around. It marks the very center, but it's not heavy enough to keep everything together. It is all of us, all the stars, all the galaxies that keeps us together, all the gravity, including dark matter. That's what keeps it together. And it's one system, indeed. But yes, indeed, it is the central point around which everything matters, but it's not keeping us there. It's more or less the, you know, the final dump where everything goes. You know, dead stars and gas, you know, that's the last point where everything can sink towards the center, and then it keeps growing. Maybe at some point, this supermassive black hole, the center of galaxies, will be, you know, outweighing everything else. But that will take many, many billions and billions and billions of years before that happens.
Could there ever be a super black hole that sucks in the universe?
I've been actually speculating about this in my book. No, I didn't. I think I left out. Okay, that was an idea I had while writing the book, actually.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering about that. Could it be? And in fact, that could be. If the universe would not expand, it would actually, black holes could grow faster than the universe and could suck up the entire universe. Fortunately, the universe expands, and thereby we outrun the force of black holes.
And what's it expanding into?
That's a very good question. Maybe space actually already exists, right? So space is there and infinite. Maybe that's the case. We just don't know. We just know that our space, our matter and energy that creates our universe, that is expanding.
If you were to reach the end of the universe, theoretically, could you touch like a wall or something?
We don't think so. We think that because wherever you are, you know, at the center of your universe. There is no center of the universe, right? You know, you have to picture the universe as a, you know, it's hard to imagine, like the surface of a balloon that inflates.
Right.
Right. So you can run around on the surface of the balloon. You're always at the surface of that, you know, two-dimensional structure, as we are on the surface of a three-dimensional structure. And the center is always, you know, in a different dimension, so to speak. So you would not necessarily see a wall. But on the other hand, that people are suggesting that if, like, two universes actually, you know, collide, there could be structures in our universe to be seen. So I think what you're asking is really at the edge of what we know at the moment.
Because if you're in a balloon, not on top of it, but if you're in it, you're going to touch it and feel some kind of end to it, even as it expands.
That's true, but then you would have to be able to think of in four dimensions. And we are living in three dimensions. And so yeah, I don't think I'm able to answer that question, really.
That's fair enough.
It goes beyond, I think, what we really are able to understand at this moment.
East of the Rockies, Hal's with us, Midland, Texas. Hi, Hal, good morning.
Hey, George, Dr. Hanel, I really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
I had a comment, and you can add your element. I think consciousness, the interesting thing about the ultimate paradox is God. Think of before he spoke the existence of existence, the Bible says some curious things, is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that's very interesting. And he knew us before we were born. So consciousness apparently existed before anything. And perhaps all consciousnesses existed before creation. And it is truly the ultimate paradox. I'll get your comment.
I think it's a great question. What is consciousness? What are we as human beings? And there are sort of two opposing views, I would say. You know, one is the view that, you know, the universe starts in very dead, so to speak, right? It's just, you know, the Big Bang, and out of this more complexity grows, and it suddenly the universe starts to think, which is crazy to think about it. The universe suddenly starts to think. But obviously, it's possible that, you know, according to natural laws, people like us are being, you know, come about, that think, that feel, that hope, that love, that pray. And then the question is that our invention or did that exist before? Right? Is that, do we just mirror what was there before? And if you look at sort of the, you know, the biblical creation story in Genesis, it says, you know, we are made in the mirror of God. So we were reflecting, you know, some, not just something, but someone who, you know, who can love, who cares, who is conscious. And so that's a question. Is, you know, is conscious, is destiny, did that precede the creation of the world? And, you know, the Christian answer is yes, it does. The scientific answer is we don't know. I think both scientifically seems to me reasonable, but we can't prove it. You can only feel it, I think,
right,
in your heart or in your faith.
David's with us in New Mexico. Hi, David. Take it away.
Yeah. Hi, George. Hi, Professor.
Hi, Davey.
My main question comment is on the speed of light and traveling faster than the speed of light, which you've stated your position on. But let me throw a couple other things at you ahead of that. And first of all, Einstein won the Nobel Prize for Physics in, I believe it was 1921. And a cousin of mine, Ernest Orlando Lawrence, won it in, I think it was 1939 for inventing the cyclotron. And I like to joke with people all my life that going around telling them that Einstein is wrong about this and this. And as you have stated, that Einstein was, in fact, wrong to some degree about black holes because he didn't believe that they existed. I also believe that we can travel faster than the speed of light. And my reasoning on that is that, to me, it's explained to us by science that light bounces off of objects and enters our eye, and we're not actually seeing the object. We're seeing the light that bounced off of it. And so it's my argument, or looking for a counter-argument, that light has a terminal speed, but my spacecraft that I fly in, just because light has a terminal speed, what is it about physics that makes it that my craft does not have a terminal speed? And then let me just throw in that I don't believe that time travel is possible, and I don't believe that wormholes are a thing. I don't believe that space is a fabric that can be warped or bent. I believe that as you see on Earth and in our solar system and nearby space, you see repeating patterns, like there's this lake, and then there's that lake, and that lake. There's this tree, and this tree, and this tree. And I believe that that pattern continues throughout the universe. And so it's a repeating thing, not just one universe. And that's an interesting question also. It's discussed over and over again, whether it's a universe or a multiverse or multiple universes. However, I never hear it defined what the definition of universe, because to me, universe is everything that exists, no matter what it is, which would then by definition include, if there were multiple quote unquote universes, to me, that's all one universe.
Yeah. Correct. So I start forgetting, you know, the beginning, because you line out so many questions, it's hard to answer them all. I mean, it's true. That's why people call it the multiverse, you know, it's sort of multi-universes. It's sort of a bit contradiction in terms. Yes, of course, the universe would be, you know, many, many, what we could now call universes, if that were true. That's correct. But the first question was, why does matter, for example, cannot go faster than the speed of light? You have to, in the end, you have to remember that, you know, even you can actually turn matter into light, and you can turn light into matter, so to speak. You can create, take two photons, and you can create a positron and electron, an antimatter particle and a matter particle. So they are sort of connected on a deeper level. And all forces that we exchange, if I hit you with a hammer, you know, on a lowest level, we are exchanging virtual photons, right? So on a quantum level, everything is exchanged with, you know, virtual exchange particles and photons. So what limits light limits matter as well. And matter has a disadvantage because it has mass. You know, it makes it heavy, makes it hard to accelerate. A photon, it has no mass. It just goes. You don't even need to accelerate it. It just goes. While matter, like a car, you know, the heavier something is, you have to accelerate. You have to put energy into it. And that's why, you know, matter can never go as fast as photons, because photons are light. They're always lighter than matter at the same energy.
Absolutely.
So that's...
That's good. That's good, Heino. Yeah, the clock's got us, Heino, so we are out of time. I want to thank you. The name of the book again, Light in the Darkness. Thank you so much. Stay in touch. Love to have you back.